The Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. Members, this morning, we're going to hear from the Minnesota Board on Judicial Standards. We will then hear from Civil Legal Services and the courts. We have some time blocked out for representatives from AFSCME and anyone from the public that wants to address the governor's budget recommendations to our division. Okay, so I need a motion also, since we have a quorum, to approve the minutes for Thursday, February the 25th, and Tuesday, March the 2nd. Representative Olin moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Mr. Paul, we will hear from you first. I understand you have a prior commitment, so we'll get you out of the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. In the last legislative session, most of you will recall that there was a separate appropriation line item established for our board for special activities in terms of trials, hearings, court reporters, court costs, this type of thing, when we have public trials. This appropriation was continued for the last biennial period. This initiative has totally remedied the funding problem that the board had for so many years. Some of you will recall that for the 5 years prior to the new appropriation, we were down to such a small amount that we could barely pay our expenses. And especially when a trial would come up, when a public hearing would come up, we were just back here with our hats in our hand asking for deficiency money. And this appropriation has proved invaluable. We now use it for investigative services. We use it to pay our attorneys. We use it to pay the attorneys of the judicial officer in the case of disability. It's been a tremendous help, and it's been able to allow the board to, one, make decisions on the basis of better evidence, and two, to save money, to spend less money, because we can pay for things directly and negotiate directly with service providers that previously we could only get through attorneys because they were willing to wait for their money, basically. And this has been a tremendous savings, and I think it's been very good in terms of the state. I know that the House budget is not out yet. The Senate just came out a day or so ago, and I have the governor's request here, and I just thought I would speak to that. The governor's request includes a $10,000 reduction for fiscal year 2010 and a $14,000 reduction for fiscal year 2011, and the same in 2012, $14,000, and the same in 2013, $14,000. Currently, we have not one but four cases, public cases that are coming up. One is a disability to which we have allocated $68,000. One is a standard misconduct case. We've allocated $50,000 for that. The third is another misconduct case, a little less serious. We've allocated $26,000 for that. And the fourth, which just actually was demanded by the judge last week, it was actually after I spoke to the Senate. We didn't know at that point what the judge was going to do, and he has since demanded a public hearing. And we have the remainder of the monies allocated to that. It will never be enough. It's $26,000. The point that I want to try to make is that if our agency is cut, we're a little bit like the courts. We have to kind of keep on rolling, and when these cases come up, we can't back off of them. We can't stop.
Excuse me, Mr. Paul. Could people please turn off your cell phones, even if they're on vibrate? It's what's causing the...
Things were fine. John Nash.
Mine's off. I'm just looking at the screen because it's fun to look at.
This is a minority responsibility, and I'm just...
Okay. Mine was on vibrate. I apologize. At any rate, we're going to be short this year. It's a little bit atypical. Usually, I come to you, I have one or possibly two cases going. This year is four, and actually, I see down the road that another one may come up. That's two. Mine is off now.
People in the audience, too, this is, it's, you really need to turn your cell phones off, or what else could be done? That's it. Sorry, Mr. Poe, go ahead.
No, I just have a few more comments. We have five attorneys retained at this time. One of the cases is a disability case. We obviously have two attorneys retained because the rule requires us to do so. Investigation fees for just the first, we estimate the first 6 months, and partially this is we spent $15,000. That's just for the first 6 months, and we have only a few more left on that. We've tried to save money in every way possible, as we did in the days prior. The majority of my evaluations are conducted by telephone. It's rare that I go out, even though it probably would be a little better, but the investigations usually take care of those types of things. I've dropped most of my in-state travel, which restricts me from going to the various districts to talk to them. If we have any balances in our operating fund, we'll transfer them over to the hearings and attorney's fees. I guess what I want to say is that we are trying very hard and striving to efficiently carry out the mission of the agency to protect the public, to promote confidence in the integrity and impartiality in the Minnesota judiciary. This agency serves a very important task, and it oversees the only agency overseeing the ethical conduct of the judiciary. It has a limited staff. It has minimal operating expenditures. These separate funds have been so valuable, and we ask that they be continued. They're necessary, and the state needs them. That concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to address any questions.
Mr. Paul, what is your, do you have like your caseload is what for per year, would you say, on average?
The full load of contacts, that is the number of calls and letters we get, is right between 1,500 and 1,600 per year. Out of that, I get maybe 120 cases. Out of those 120 cases, we get responses for maybe 40 of them or 45 of them. And there is usually discipline in one degree or another in maybe 25 of those cases. Some of the discipline is a lot more severe than others, but most of them is not very severe. It's just it's done by agreement between the judge and the board.
So how do you sort of, so the 1,500 to 1,600 calls, so that's from clients, other attorneys, people calling, complaining?
It's from everybody, the general public.
And then you have some criteria to sort of weed those out into ones that might be actionable in some way where you would pursue it?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I weed out the letters like that in the sense that if the letters contain allegations the board can consider, then I begin to evaluate them. If they don't contain those allegations, I try to get back to the people and say, you need to pursue your case in court, you need to go here, need to go there. There's a true need for interaction with the public because they don't always know exactly where they should go. They aren't always familiar with what our powers are.
And then 120 cases a year on average rise to the level where you think it might be something where the board would intervene.
Those are the cases in which the complaints contain allegations that the board may consider and the board feels that there's some reason to pursue them.
And then the 45 then are the ones that you actually do a more thorough investigation using your existing staff.
Those are the ones.
And 25 then are ones that you take direct action on.
Yes. Would that be existing staff is just me. I'm the only one who does it.
And the proposed reduction would mean what, again?
The proposed reduction would mean that somewhere along the line, with four cases, which is, given it's certainly an unusual amount, I think it's going to maintain itself for a couple of years, but it's more than two times to three times more than what we usually get. But we will run out of the money to pursue these cases earlier. It's just It's just that simple, and I'll have to come back, and I'll have to try to get the deficiency appropriation, because we've got these four cases, and there's just nothing that we, you know, we're not in control of the cases we get.
Okay, we have a couple questions for you, Reverend Simcoes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paul, can you inform the committee what other states do with regard to supervision or investigation of complaints against judges? Are we sort of the norm? Is an agency like yours the norm? Is it unique? Help me understand how other states do this.
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are basically in the norm. There are a few states who do this work through their lawyers' boards, so they do both lawyers and judges, but there is no state that does not do this work, and we are right in the norm. Most of the states do what we do. They are, of course, varying size. New York has a four-office complex and all over the state, and its budget is millions, and so is California, but in terms of size, we're about in the middle. I can get you a little more information on that if you would like.
Mr. Chair, one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paul, have you has your agency ever engaged even in preliminary conversations with the lawyers board about whether consolidation of the services provided by your agency and the lawyers board may make sense from an efficiency perspective or a cost savings perspective?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we've never engaged in those conversations. If in our state, it would not make sense because there are too many conflicts between that type of activity for lawyers and the type of activity for judges. There are influence type of issues, impartiality type of issues. It would not make sense to do that. Also, another major problem is that the lawyers' board, you know, is funded with lawyer contributions. We could never be funded that way because it would be conflicting.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Mr. Paul, I appreciate the distinction you're making. I appreciate the issue about conflicts. I would just encourage you and everybody else to recognize that we're in a situation where the status quo is no longer going to work. And so we need to think about new ways to do things. I understand, I appreciate the work that you've done and that you're doing. This isn't a criticism of that. But we all need to be thinking about new ways to do things. The lawyers' board may not be the right answer. I would suggest that the status quo isn't going to be acceptable going forward, just because it's not working. We're broken. That's across the board. That's not unique to you or anybody else. That's Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety, and lots of agencies outside of this committee's jurisdiction. So I just think we all need to start thinking about ways to do things differently, and we have to be willing to try some things and take some risk because the status quo isn't going to continue to work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is this. You suggested that you have 1,500 to 1,600 calls or letters coming in, complaints a year, and that a number of those you've handled simply by discussing with the caller, and I heard you testify, redirect them to their attorney or to court or suggest the action. Do you have a feel for the number that of these calls that were resolved by you that could have been resolved but for a temporary breakdown of the attorney-client relationship, that the question could have been directed to their attorney,
Mr.
instead
Paul.
Of you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are about, usually the 1,600 is divided up into usually about 300 calls from judges, 300 to 350 calls from judges getting advice on various ethical issues that arise. And then the remainder is the public and lawyers. Lawyers are our lowest group. It's mostly the general public, and it's about, usually in every year, it's about 1,000 calls I get from the general public. And out of those, I might have a feel for, but it'd only be speculation, it'd be a guess, but there's no one else to guess this but me, but I would say maybe a third to 40% of those calls, if there had not been a breakdown between their idea of what their lawyer can do for them and their idea of what they feel should have been done for them, That might be a good figure for that.
Nothing else, thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to, any other questions?
Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paul, sorry I missed some of your presentation, but when a judge is found to have acted improperly or had a hearing and, you know, there was some kind of disciplinary action taken, is the judge ever required to do and to compensate the board for any of those expenses? I'm sorry if that question's been asked and I missed it somewhere.
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in a sense, we don't have any money ourselves. Everything we have comes through the legislature. We have no rules or anything that allows us to find and keep the money. So when we fine a judge, which does happen on occasion, happened twice last year, that money goes into the general fund. It doesn't come to us, in other words. It comes into the general fund, which ultimately defrays, I suppose, our appropriation.
Representative.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Paul, are those fines, what is the fine based on?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the fines are based on the board's best evaluation of what the misconduct was and what effect it has on the judiciary, and those are the factors that it uses. For example, if there, we had one, this has been made public, but there's no point to put a name to it. But there was a case in which a judge had incarcerated and sentenced a person without any kind of hearing, without any kind of notice to the prosecutor, without any kind of and actually utilized the sheriff through the telephone to do the work. And in that case, there was a fine of about $5,000, if I remember correctly. And it was, that's the kind of cases in which the board fines when it's that kind of. The board finds usually when there's some kind of personal interest in it. In this case, the judge was trying to protect his neighbors. So that's the, when it's a personal interest in it like that, then the board might consider fines. It doesn't fine on all of those cases. It might on some, though. You know, what the board does sometimes is not exactly predictable for me. So.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Paul, I know that this is a, to me, this has become kind of a an issue of interest. I've had numerous groups that have approached me on this particular issue in terms of judicial discipline, and I know that that has kind of come to your office in order to impart that, but the general demeanor that I get from those individuals is that there is no accountability. One of the instances that you cite is kind of classic in that they see judges who are abusing their power from the bench, and then they put in a request to the Board of Judicial Standards and aren't receiving a response. Maybe some of them are, maybe some of them aren't. But I think probably even more onerous to us as a legislative body is that it's in the Constitution that the legislature has the responsibility for oversight over the judicial branch as part of the checks and balances under Article 6, Section 9. And we abrogated that responsibility. And I think last year we had an ad hoc meeting that tried to get the voice of some of these people to be able to feel like they were having a voice down here at the Capitol, and it was pretty compelling testimony. I end this by saying I think there is more here than meets the eye. I think there is a need for a legislative investigation into how is this part of our responsibility functioning as a state. And I think that if we're cutting the Board of Judicial Standards budget, we may be cutting off the only venue we have towards some kind of checks and balances between the three separation of powers. And it causes me significant concern because there is a growing movement in the state that there is non-accountability on the judicial side. Not to say that we have a whole bunch of rogue judges, but even if you've got 1 or 2%, they have a direct connection to people who can actually destroy their lives, and I've seen some of them. So I just say that to say that I know you serve an important function, and I would really like to see us as a legislature kind of step up to the plate and do a quality control on that process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Mr. Paul?
Can I just comment, Representative Severson, that it is impossible for me not to have responded to any call or any letter. I respond to every one of them. To say that I did not respond would be not accurate. Some of them don't get the responses that they want, some, and I, of course, am limited by our rules, but I respond to every one of them.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Out of curiosity, of the 1,600 calls that you get per year, two questions. What is the number of calls coming from not judges, not attorneys, but the public involved in a lawsuit? And of those calls, what number of those have not had an attorney and are their own attorney pro se?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Paul.
Representative, it is about 60% of the total 1,600 calls. And you're asking me, I believe, what percentage of those do not have an attorney
yes.
at the time they call? Because some of them have had attorneys and then have many, some of them had several attorneys and then have none by the time they call. And some of them have never had an attorney. But should I group those together?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
I would say about maybe a fourth, 25 to 30%, either have never had an attorney or do not have an attorney at the time they call.
Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're doing a good job at grouping numbers. Can you tell me then what's the number of that? What is the percent of the 60% have never had attorney, been attorney pro se from day one that are calling you? Is it 5? Is it 10? Is it 100?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul.
I'm not sure if I can. I don't keep track of the statistics that way, and it's difficult to do because they don't always want to tell you, or if they may not recollect, or there are some problems in that. It would be difficult for me to parse it that way. I don't know how to answer that question.
Thanks. Mr. Paul, just throwing this out as a possible option, that to what Representative Coles was talking about, just in terms of our budget difficulties, might be a better question for Ms. DeSalle when she comes up here, but I'm wondering if other states are charging judges an annual fee that could be used to offset some of the costs of your organization's work. Do you have any knowledge of that, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, I never heard of that. Doesn't strike me as being a very good public relations gambit for us, but
might be for us.
Yeah, it might well be. But I've never actually heard that. I've never heard of that being done. The problem with any kind of fee-based, and no matter what you propose, there are going to be, possible conflicts that we really have to watch out for. And the problem with any type of fee-based funding of an organization like ours is we are an independent agency. I mean, you fund us. The Supreme Court adopts our rules. The executive appoints our members, in some cases subject to the Senate. But we are a truly independent agency, and it is that aspect of our agency that really, I think, allows us to have so much credibility across the state. But we are completely independent and have no political or any other kinds of stimulus that we have to worry about. So it no matter what you do, let's say a judge doesn't pay for a few months, and then when we get a complaint on him or her, and the judge will start to say that, well, I just, because I didn't pay, and now I get a complaint. I mean, it's endless, and it's just best for us not to get involved with that, in my view. I know it's difficult, and I would like to, the representative is no longer here who talked about how broken the state is. I recognize that just like everybody else does, and I can commit to this committee that we will do everything we can to save money. We are in the process of doing that. That for us, it's a never-ending process, but we do have rules. These rules have recently been revised, and under these rules, the expenses are a lot higher for us than they ever were before. For example, now judges have 30 days to respond from the date that they get our request, and there's no way to determine when that is unless we send it certified. So instead of spending 44 cents on a letter, we end up spending $6, and it's going to be like a $1,000 difference. There are all kinds of matters like that in the rules, which we are not in control of, but which we are fighting to try to control at all times.
We have one more question, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this might not be the proper person to ask, but I really want to go on with your fee. I'm curious as to if judges do pay the lawyer's fee, because they are all lawyers, so are they already paying the fee? And if so, then I think we're already getting that fee. But I'm all for looking for creative fees, Mr. Chair. So.
Well, we can ask Mr. Saul about that. But any other questions of Mr. Paul?
Mr. Chairman, not a question, but I'd like to offer a counterpoint. I think in the area of justice, we ought not to charge fees for access to receiving justice, but what we might consider is assigning every Minnesotan at birth an attorney without whose advice they could do nothing. That might take a bite out of the discipline problem and afford better and more equal access to justice.
We should put that into bill form, a rider language for us. Anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Paul?
Well, thank you.
We'll look carefully at your budget. We probably may have you back. Thank you very much. Next, we'll hear from Civil Legal Services. Mr. Hurd, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, committee staff, thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today to discuss the impact of likely supplemental budget reductions on Minnesota's civil legal services. My name is Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. Today, I'm representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition, and I'm here to speak to the impact of the civil legal services component of the Supreme Court budget. By way of an overview, my presentation will cover three topics. First, I'll provide a general description of Minnesota's civil legal services system. Second, I will try to give you a sense of the impact the state's investment in civil legal services is having in our communities, both in terms of promoting public safety and in helping lower-income Minnesotans cope with the impact of the recession. I'll also describe how civil legal services helps relieve pressure on the state's budget and the essential role civil legal services plays in sustaining the integrity of the state's justice system. Finally, I'll try to provide some context to support the committee's effort to develop its supplemental budget recommendation. Minnesota Legal Services Coalition is a statewide resource. It's comprised of the seven regional legal services agencies that are members of the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition. Our members provide services in every county in the state. Joining me today at this meeting are in the audience are representatives from Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, Kathy Hockadahl, and Paul Day from Anishinaabe Legal Services, serving the populations on the reservations in northern Minnesota. In addition to the services provided through the seven regional legal assistance agencies, state civil legal services funding also supports legal assistance services provided by an additional two dozen community-based agencies and special practice programs. Together, these regional and local legal services providers share the mission of assuring open, affordable, and understandable access to the justice system for low-income and senior citizen Minnesotans. They provide direct legal assistance to Minnesota families, handling approximately 52,900 cases in 2008, reaching nearly 70,000 Minnesotans through legal education and preventative law services, and providing a very well-used web-based resource. The services delivered through Minnesota's Civil Legal Services have a real impact in improving the lives of Minnesota residents. They help people solve problems that result in real changes, reducing family and domestic violence, keeping kids in school, securing housing, assuring access to health care, helping families achieve economic self-sufficiency, and ensuring that our most vulnerable are protected and are treated fairly. While many Minnesotans benefit from the assistance offered by civil legal services providers, the need remains great. Based upon the last census, It is estimated that 1.2 million Minnesotans qualify for services, and that approximately two-thirds of the need for assistance goes unmet. In other words, for each person who receives service, two are turned away. And in a time of severe economic challenges and chronic budget pressures, it becomes even more difficult to close the gap in need. In the past year, Minnesota's legal aid programs experienced a 40% increase in requests for services. The simple fact is that our services are counter-cyclical. The need for civil legal services increases during times of economic downturns, and many of those new people coming through our doors seeking help to cope with the recession's impact are people who did not ever expect to need or even qualify for services from a legal aid agency. As noted by Brown County District Court Judge John Rodenberg, needs rise in five areas during economic downturns. One, evictions. Two, foreclosures. Three, domestic violence. Four, credit problems. And five, crime. When you look at this list, four of the five are among civil legal services priority service areas. The point is that in addition to being an essential part of Minnesota's justice system, providing access to justice, civil legal services also needs to be considered to be part of the state's overall strategy for helping Minnesotans cope with the impact of this economic recession. As most of you know, civil legal services also has an important impact on public safety. One of our largest substantive service areas is in family law, including addressing the impact of domestic and sexual violence. In fact, a recent study showed that the one factor that could be correlated with reductions in rates and the resulting harm of domestic violence in a community is the availability of legal services in that community. As part of our work in this area, legal aid also played an important role in helping to develop a tool that is now in expanded use in courtrooms throughout the state to help judges assess the lethality in domestic violence cases. Legal aid services also have an impact on public safety by reducing school failure and truancies by helping families stabilize their housing. Success in school has shown to have a significant impact on the community and public safety by reducing long-term risk for criminal behavior. In addition to promoting economic security and public safety, civil legal services plays a critical role in lowering the cost of government in Minnesota. When legal aid helps a family resolve a housing issue, which it did in over 2,650 cases during the past year, we also help reduce the need for $4 million in tax-supported shelter. By resolving child support problems, we bring down the annual need for public assistance payments by approximately $4 million. And each year, we help Minnesotans secure federal disability benefits, which reduces state spending on cash assistance and health care programs by approximately $5 million every year. That produces a cumulative impact of $275 million in state health and human services cost reductions over 10 years. Civil legal services, along with the courts and public defenders, are an essential element in Minnesota's justice system and a core government service. As observed by Chief Justice Magnuson, in tough economic times, we need to pay attention to the basics. And in our state, in our society, one of the basics is an adequately funded justice system, a system that includes civil legal services, not only to ensure access to justice for all, but also to make Minnesota's justice system more efficient. Civil legal services is, in some respects, an efficiency program within the justice system. Legal aid reduces the number of cases with unrepresented parties appearing in courts, a valuable time saver in the courtroom. We also relieve burdens on the courts by keeping out approximately 3,000 cases every year because we have advised those clients that they do not have a legal claim. our ability to work with clients to find alternatives to resolving civil legal disputes reduces court costs by approximately $5 million annually. If civil legal services were not already a part of Minnesota's justice system, the courts would have to create it in order to maintain current efficiencies. Because we've had to deal with inadequate funding for a very long time, operating economically and efficiently is a way of doing business in legal aid. Evaluating and improving our systems for delivering services, as observed by District Court Judge David Knutson, is an ongoing, integrated part of how we do our work. We have seen over a 10% reduction in service capacity through the past several years. At Smurls, we've lost 15% of our attorney staff in the past 2 years. MMLA closed their office in Cambridge and have laid off staff. We have allocated resources to limit the focus of our work to crisis needs. We've integrated technological innovations to ease access to services and improve efficiency of internal systems. We have found ways to keep costs low by collaborating on training for our staff and other professionals who help us meet our clients' needs. And perhaps most importantly, we have benefited from the high-quality, high-value services provided by a motivated workforce and committed volunteers, a workforce that delivers results even though their salaries are the lowest in the justice system.
Mr. Hurd, could you wrap up pretty quickly? I don't know how much time you have. I want to give ample opportunity for questions about your budget.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
In fact, I have a question right here. Did you, Mr. Lesh, did you want to?
I can wait to the end.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Because of recent cuts in our funding, civil legal services is below our funding level from 2006. We're the only part of the justice system that's at that level. Last year, because of some unfortunate one-time funding issues from the prior budget cycle, our cut was approximately 8.3% compared to the overall 0.83% the justice system took. We're here today to ask that the justice system, including civil legal services, be treated in a proportionate manner. I'm certainly willing to take any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you for your presentation. We have a few already. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hurd, in recent years, we've seen a glut of individuals coming forward that are affected by collateral consequences of previous criminal convictions, which is, of course, outside the parameters of what the public defenders are dealing with. How often or in what type of case do you end up having to deal with that for your clients, things like those?
Mr. Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, we run into that fairly often in employment-related and in housing-related cases where criminal convictions do have collateral consequences in people being able to obtain either employment or housing. We have been working to, in appropriate cases, have some of those convictions expunged to clear the person's record and get them access, but those continue to be problems.
Mr. Chair, the reason I bring that up is because we've seen the public defenders recently lobby this committee as it pertains to certain collateral consequences issues, and I tell them each time that it seems to me that that's the proper purview of civil legal services. So I am curious, and I'd be interested and curious to know what ongoing things you're doing so we're not reinventing the wheel or duplicating efforts with parallel agencies that this committee is funding.
Did you want to comment on that, Mr. Hurd?
I'll try, Mr. Chairman. I don't believe, Representative, that there is duplication. I think what there is a huge gap right now. Because of the limited resources that both public defenders and civil legal services have, there are services that are not being provided. And unless the consequences really impact a critical basic need, it is very difficult for civil legal services to assist those clients.
Representative.
I didn't want to get into discussion about this, Mr. Chair, but this is my point. I understand that there is a gap, Mr. Hurd. The public defenders are greatly overburdened in what their actual charge is, which is to deal with individuals that have charges pending in front of them in the criminal court. And to have to put people on the job of dealing with collateral consequences, too, seems to me to be outside of their mission. So that's why I'm curious. Regardless of the gap, there's no question there's a gap. A lot of the agencies we fund are going to have gaps right now, but that's why I brought it up.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You referenced in your PowerPoint presentation that you secure $4 million in child support payments annually in new court orders. Is that statewide, or is that just within Smurl's jurisdiction?
Mr. Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that is statewide.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, what's your definition of new court orders? Is there a time cutoff? Are there cases you're not taking? What is the definition of a new court?
Mr. Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, new court orders would be new cases coming to us where we obtain a child support order where there was not one previously.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So then anyone with a pre-existing child support order that's not being paid, you won't take the case?
Mr. Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. We, in this number, did not include any collection efforts we may have made to make those orders result in real dollars to the clients. I was only in that number including the total of new child support orders.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think a last question. Refresh my memory. How are your guidelines of what cases you take and don't take established? Who establishes those? And are you aware of any other state in the union that has a legislative overview setting their standards, or some other source?
Mr. Hurd.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, to answer your last question first, I am not aware of whether there is any kind of legislative priority setting. And there are some differences amongst programs in Minnesota as to how they set priorities. In general, all of the programs obtain input from both their client communities and from other agencies serving their clients and from community leaders about the most important critical legal issues facing low-income people. The boards of directors of each of the programs are the ones who have the final say as far as the priorities set by that program, and many times those are budget-driven.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, do you have a written set of guidelines that your board in Smurls has established for cases that can be taken and them that cannot? Do you have a written set of guidelines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, yes, we do.
Mr. Chairman, I think this committee should see it. I'd like to see a copy of that.
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly provide that.
Very good. Thank
That's
you.
That's all.
Representative Coles?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll, because of the time, I'll withhold on my comment and just make a request of Mr. Hurd. The only comment would be to thank you for our visit yesterday. Thank you for your advocacy. Obviously, we have huge challenges. I'm hoping, Mr. Hurd, that you can provide me and the committee with information. I'm looking at your slide here. I don't need it today. In fact, I'd prefer that you follow up with me on it. I appreciate the breakdown of the state appropriation. I'd be interested in having a better understanding of basically the bottom line number for, or I should say the top line number for the Civil Legal Services Organizations over the this 2006 to 2011 time frame. What is your sort of all-in number, and how does that break down? I see the state appropriation. I assume that's the general fund appropriation. I believe you may receive some other state resources, recording a portion of the recording fee and things like that, federal funds, grant funds, private donations. I want to see how your top line has moved over the last several years. That, I think, will help me as I evaluate what recommendations I may be making to the chair. If you can provide that to me, and I think the whole committee, I would appreciate
that. That'd be
that.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly provide that.
Thank you. Last question, I'm going to move on, and we'll have legal aid back here once we get our target and start going through our budget a little bit more closely. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass. The other two representatives covered it.
Just quickly, Mr. Hood, the governor is recommending a 6% cut to your base budget. What impact would that be to legal aid services?
A 6% cut would result in about 2,100 additional Minnesotans or Minnesota families not being able to receive services through legal aid. That's in addition to the approximately 3,000 people who lost services because of the cuts last year.
How many attorneys would be laid off?
We would lose approximately a dozen employees with the governor's recommended cuts.
Any other questions at this point? We'll have you back, Mr. Hurd, and if you could provide the committee with the information that's been requested, appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee.
Then now we'll have a presentation on the state of the judiciary. I'm not sure in what order you'd like to do this. Ms. Dussault.
Mr. Chairman and members of the division, my name for the record is Sue DeSalle. I'm the state court administrator, and I'm joined today by a number of witnesses who will help present our current budget situation. We very much appreciate the opportunity of appearing before you today, and we are very grateful for this division's support for the judiciary as a core government function over the years, and especially now in these very challenging economic times. I'm going to start out to kind of paint the picture, give you a little overview of where we are today, and then move to the governor's recommendation and its impact. To put this in context, the judicial branch has been underfunded for some period of time. In the last recession in 2004-05, just as we were bringing over the largest of our judicial districts to state funding, we had a $23 million shortfall. No restoration in the following biennium, and then 2008-09, we had about a $19 million biennial shortfall, including a $4 million base cut. In this current biennium, we had a $5 million base cut, and we've had to absorb an additional $6.3 million in unavoidable personnel costs for statutorily mandated increases in the employer pension contribution, for health insurance increases, and for the annualization in this year of the 2009 contractually required step increases for our employees. So our branch budget essentially got hit another $12 million in this biennium. And because of this chronic funding, underfunding situation, we are now operating 10% short staff, with 250 fewer positions than we had in 2008. We've done this by implementing a voluntary separation program, a voluntary leave without pay, hiring freeze statewide, and we have had to do some layoffs. To contain the cost, we have also negotiated with our three statewide unions, or the three unions, a 0% merit, 0% across the board, or ATB, increases for this biennium. And in addition, in the 8th district, they have gone to cutting their work hours from a 40-hour work week to 37.5, which is an effective 6.25% pay cut for their employees. In addition, as part of the budget plan to close the gap, we are now holding open all judge vacancies for at least a minimum of 4 months, and we have cut retired judge use, and together that has exacerbated our current judge shortage. In addition, we've taken cuts to drug courts, and to try to deal with those cuts, as well as with the expiring federal startup monies and other funding shortfalls, we applied for a $3.9 million federal stimulus grant. Unfortunately, there were 3,000 other applicants nationwide for only $225 million, and we were unsuccessful in that. We've also cut mandated services and operating budgets. We've closed public counters now in more than half of our judicial districts, a half a day a week, canceled most of our educational expenses. And finally, because of the chronic underfunding situation and with the certainty of continued fiscal pressures for at least the next 3 years, the Judicial Council felt that it is necessary to change the way that it allocates funding to the judicial districts. In the past, the counties were put into three groups based on size, with the smaller courts receiving funding based on proportionally more staff per judge, in recognition that smaller courts can't realize the same economies of scale and efficiencies of the large courts. With the continued fiscal pressures, the council concluded that we can no longer afford to provide low-volume, geographically dispersed areas with proportionally higher staff levels. So all courts now are funded on the same workload basis, and we call this either the most efficient norm or the lowest norm. Now, recognizing that this is going to have a significant impact in some areas, the Judicial Council agreed to phase this in over a three-year period. We hope, would allow time for adjustment to smaller budgets and staff levels, hopefully through attrition, and also to allow us to implement some planned technology initiatives that will allow these courts to operate with smaller budgets and fewer staff. These include the centralized payables initiative, e-filing, and some other things I'll talk about in just a few minutes. Still, it is expected that even with more technology in these low-volume areas, smaller budgets are going to translate into less service. And this likely is going to mean that in some counties there will be a restricting of hours, perhaps even days, of court business. And later in the presentation, you're going to hear from Tim Osby, who's the Judicial District Administrator in the 7th and 8th Judicial Districts, and he's going to talk more specifically about the impact of this move to the lowest norm in his area. Now, we haven't been sitting back and just cutting. Instead, we have been redoubling our efforts to find court process efficiencies and to expand the use of technology to reduce cost, with the objective of trying to do whatever we can to continue to provide Minnesotans with as much quality, justice, and service as possible. With your help last session in passing important legislative change, we are now in the process of centralizing all of the citations, the processing of citations, and the collection of old debt statewide. This fall, we launched what we call the Court Payment Center, or CPC, and we'll be transitioning the 85 counties into the centralized processing on a phased basis in this biennium. Hennepin Ramsey have their own separate centralized processing. The plan is to fold Hennepin Ramsey into that single centralized processing effort in the next biennium. Now, the goals, of course, as we talked to you last session, were to save money, to increase the collections of overdue revenue, and to provide alternative and acceptable levels of service. And this is going to be particularly crucial in those areas that are moving to this lowest norm. Now, centralized payables processing actually involves five separate components or initiatives, projects, and includes the centralized citation data entry, centralized call centers for questions anywhere in the state, a centralized mail, phone, and online payments system. We've also automated now the fine splits, which was made possible because of the legislation you passed last session to help streamline and clarify the very complicated maze of fine distribution. And we also have an automated referral of old debt to collections now. So as I said, we launched this initiative officially in October. As of Monday, we have 26 counties that have implemented one or more of these components. By the end of the session in May, we expect that to increase to 51. Our goal, as I indicated, is to bring over all 85 counties outside of the metro area in this biennium on all of these components. In addition to the centralized...
Mr. Sauer, we have a question at this point, so maybe I'll just, because we're also going to have some time constraints here, Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few questions. I also am looking at your case priority list, and I see non-traffic, traffic, and parking. Are those now all part of that centralized payable, all of these that are in blue?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, they are. They are. That is the vision of bringing those all into the centralized processing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also received an email stating that the administrative penalties that we passed, which allowed local units of government to do tickets, now are doing them as misdemeanors, and we're starting to have public defenders appointed in those cases. Would those also fall in your automatic payables, or are those outside of that?
Mr. Chair
and Representative Hellstrom, they're outside. They're collecting their own. That's not part of our process.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one last question. I also was part of the plan to collect some of the old revenue. Are there other consequences that have resulted from those lack of bills not being paid? For example, did people lose their driver's license as part of the fact that there were all these old debts? I think the answer is yes, because I've at least heard from one.
Ms. DeSalle.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hellstrom, in some of these cases, it would result in the suspension of driver's license, correct?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so did that increase any of the caseload surrounding this with new cases of folks losing their license at all, or is that going to be cleaned up soon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hellstrom, generally the first step is to suspend the license, and then if they don't pay, then it goes to collection.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how old could that debt have been, which resulted in folks losing their license currently?
Mr. Saw.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hellstrom, I might have to get back to you on that, but you know, typically it is within a short period of time. If they have not paid within a short period of time, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, you know, right now there all of the 87 counties have been doing different things, so there's no standard. But in the future, it would be within 30 days. It would go to DVS for suspension of license, and then I'm not sure if it's 30 days after that or 60 days after that when it would be sent to collection.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is more a comment than anything I'm going to address, because I understand, but in representing a district that's very much Greater Minnesota and very much in the middle of this situation where counties' hours, et cetera, are going to get cut, I would be shirking any responsibility I might have to my district to not comment that I hate to see this effort being done. Being in the legal system, I understand somewhat what you're trying to do, but I cannot and will not be very supportive of any cuts of hours and services done to Kitson County, Red Lake County, Lake of the Woods, et cetera. Not all of which I represent, but some of which I represent, and the rest are all bordering on mine, so I am vehemently opposed to that effort, and that's all I'm going to say.
Mr. Sauer, you want to continue? And also, are you going to be addressing the governor's recommendation to your budget? I don't see it on your handout.
I will.
Okay,
and
thank
just,
you.
Just
a little worried about time here, too, because we have some people that want to address from AFSCME, and we have session, and we're going to go a little bit longer than our 10 o'clock time, but
Mr. Chair, I'll move right along. I just wanted to address Representative Olin's comments because we couldn't agree with you more. We wish we were not in this situation. Something's got to give. We're doing the very best to understand that this is not business as usual and that these budget problems are not going away. We're doing our very best to make the most of the limited resources that the legislature gives us. And we would appreciate any help in figuring out how best to take these kinds of cuts and to indicate to you what the magnitude of the consequence is in real life, in counties, and for the citizens we serve. I'm not going to go through the rest of this list here other than to say that we are very aggressively pursuing every expansion of technology that we can in order to take down costs, reduce manual labor, and to be mindful of the fiscal pressures that are before us. And I do that really to just assure you that the judicial branch takes seriously its responsibility to maximize the use of these scarce resources that you give us. And so these are just many of the initiatives that are underway. In addition, in your packet, we have information on the work of our Access and Service Delivery Committee. We had a significant effort last year, a follow-on effort this year to look at how we can do business differently and more efficiently and with less cost in a variety of these areas. None of them are going to be easy. They are very controversial, including redistricting, reducing the number of districts, using subordinate judicial officers in matters, trying to get pro bono help from lawyers perhaps in handling conciliation court around the state and the like. So here's just a list. I'd be happy to come back and or to talk with any of you individually about that. Let me move on then to the governor's proposed cuts. So, you know, while we have this underfunded system, public counters closed in half of our districts, we're operating 10% short. The governor has recommended to the judicial branch about a $13.7 million cut in addition to the cut of civil legal services that you heard about earlier. What this is going to mean overall for us is an additional 77 positions that will be lost on top of the 250 that we have already experienced the loss of, 13% short staffed. With fewer people, we need this less service, backlogs, and delays are building across the state. You're going to hear more about that from our other presenters, but just as an example, right now, 25% of our serious felonies are taking longer than 1 year to dispose, we're having delays that are, you know, doubling across the state in all kinds of case types. The national time standards for case processing, our own statutory time standards requires that all felonies should be disposed within 1 year. And so, you know, why do we care about this? Of course, because justice delayed is justice denied, but also because the only thing that has been empirically shown to reduce recidivism is the swiftness between the date of offense and the imposition of a judicial sanction. Now, you know, with your help, we over the years have moved from, you know, 2 drug courts to 38. Cuts have been taken in this area, and we now know that there will be significant risk to closure of these drug courts. We've already closed the Chicago Juvenile Drug Court, and there are 7 others around the state that are in jeopardy of closing under the current cut, let alone an additional cut. And finally, these technology and efficiency projects that I have covered just a few minutes ago, many of them are at risk with this funding cut. So with that, if I could move along and
ask. We have a question from Representative Lash before you move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. DeSalle, you spoke of opportunities to implement efficiencies like attorneys handling conciliation court, or I don't know if it's conciliation court or housing, referee matters, family matters.
If that's the case, what kind of benefits are there that you offer attorneys to do this kind of stuff? Is it just sheer pro bono?
Mr. Sal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, right now it's out of the goodness of their heart, and they are volunteering. There are some that are already doing this pro bono in Ramsey County, and in fact that's where we got the idea, and the expansion legislation was passed last year. We have a number of programs that are in the process of starting up in around the state where lawyers are willing to do this pro bono. We're having some Minneapolis firms willing to do this in Dakota County. So we think that's a possibility. There are some ethical issues right now that we're working with to try to figure out how best to arrange this with practicing lawyers serving as judges, but we think that's a possibility. And we are looking at it in other venues besides Conciliation Court, but we're starting there.
Well, and the reason I asked, Mr. Chair, is just as by way of suggestion, and by the way, that's not my phone, Representative Coles, I turned it off. You know, it would, in terms of return on investment, it may be worthwhile to maybe shave off a few CLE requirements for some of these lawyers. Because I know I get toward the end of my cycle and I find ways to make them up. And that's, of course, obviously solely the prerogative of the Supreme Court. But just a suggestion.
Thank you.
Mr. Sell, are you going to respond at all to the governor's recommendation on the transfer of the implied consent jurisdiction, or was that someone else going to do that, or at a later time? Or?
But Mr. Chair, this is part of the ASD recommendations, looking at what are the core things that we do. We did study that. There's no objection. We agree in concept that it could be transferred to the Office of Administrative Hearing. Our concern was that we did not want our budget to be penalized as a result of it. It's a small amount of work, about two judgeships statewide. So it would be impossible for us to peel off, you know, judgeship somehow to make up for that. And as I understand, the governor's budget doesn't penalize us for that any more than just kind of a standard cut that he's given at this level.
Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is that even though you would no longer be doing the implied consent cases, you'd be getting the same amount of money that you're currently getting.
That's just
correct?
Included in the 3% cut. They didn't do a 3% cut plus something else. That's the recommendation of the governor, at least.
Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree that maybe that should happen, but then how do we pay? It would be, maybe, are we going to have the ALJs then come and talk to us about how we would pay for it? Because if we don't take the money from one area and give it to another, and then we give new work to a new area, how do we pay for something like that?
I don't have an answer for that, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the only reason why I'm, you know, prolonging the discussion about this is because we're actually in the middle of hearing this very issue in my committee of implied consent, and I think that members would have benefited from listening to this debate in your committee, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick, quick one. You know, the drug court cuts are really hurt a lot of greater Minnesota areas as well. I'm one of them that is in my area is in jeopardy. And it's just like the census serve programs. When we look at programs that are efficient and cost effective and save the taxpayers, yet we cut those kind of things. It angers me or frustrates me. But I wanted to just pass on a suggestion that I got from a county commissioner north of me on video arraignments. And I'd just like to get your feedback on that, because according to this county commissioner north of me, video arraignments is a way that could save the state, the counties, the judicial branch significant dollars. Can you comment on that, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair,
Mr.
and
Saw.
Representative Ward, as you indicated here, we have proposals before the Supreme Court right now, and it's out for public comment on significant expansion of the use of ITV in criminal matters. And I think we're addressing this with agreement from all of the justice partners. And so that we hope and expect they'll act on that this spring.
Representative Olin, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to make a comment, being from the district that originated the whole idea of ITB use. And it has been working very well in the Pennington County, Yorozo County, et cetera, area, because we've probably used it and expanded it beyond what we were supposed to, because Judge Murphy was one of the original people that pushed it, and this is a great idea. Mrs. Saw?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to understand how long you're going to be going. Here, and he's got to go back for a criminal sexual conduct trial, and I just want to make sure that...
Judge Toussaint, do you want to, are you, because I don't want to just give you a minute, and then would you like to come back and talk about the Court of Appeals so we can, or would you like to go ahead and present? I'm just trying to, if we get out of here by 5 after, would be fine, but I want to give the folks from AFSCME the 15 minutes we allotted to them. So I'll leave it up to you. I'm afraid we probably didn't schedule this.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll yield, and if necessary, we'll come back.
Okay, Judge, thank you very much, because I think we need to have the court come back.
Mr. Chair, it's your decision. Do I have time to
How long?
Take a look?
Judge, of course you do. How much time do you need? How much time do you need?
Mr. Chair, I've been slashing and burning everything I was going to say until I'm down to about 30 seconds.
Oh no, you can take some more time. Very good welcome to the committee. Miss your presence down here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is quite an experience being here. I see an awful lot of familiar faces. Some changes. There's less hair on top of Representative Lesch's head. More, yeah, and more underneath Representative Cornish's chin. But a lot of familiar faces, some new faces. I appreciate the incredibly difficult work that you've got to do this year. And I recognize the commitment that this committee has shown, including the members of the committee who showed that commitment a year ago when the courts had its budget. How many times have we all said it in this room? Public safety is a core function of government. And you've protected that and you've stood by that. Because of the changes that have had to come, we've had tough times in the courts. I won't kid you about that. And yeah, we're down judges. Yeah, judges haven't had pay increases in a while. That's just fine by me. That's not my concern. My concern is the people that we've got in the court system who are the lifeblood of getting things done. Our court administrative staff, our law clerks, our court reporters, and we're down 10%. As I sit in Anoka County within the 10th Judicial District. We're 10% down there. We've done things in the 10th District like closing a courthouse, like closing windows, and that's having real impact. We're hearing stories about that, and we're hearing stories about that statewide. There was a case in Aiken County where there was a woman who needed her divorce decree in order to qualify for some benefits, and nobody had gotten to it. It was in the pile, and she was at the risk of losing some real severe benefits as a result of that. We've got criminal hearings that are getting pushed out well past a year. We've got conciliation court hearings that are getting pushed out 8-10 months. And you think, conciliation court, what's the big deal in conciliation court? These are the people who are our neighbors. These are the people that you see every day who feel that the court system are a place that they can getting the relief, getting the help. But we're in a situation in the courts where we don't have the staff. Sometimes we've got judges who don't have staff who can go into the courtrooms with us because we're so shorthanded on things. And it limits our ability to serve the public. That's not what we're about. I know it's not what you want to leave things at for us either. I do know that your commitment has been strong. You've seen the presentation as to the kinds of things that the Judicial Council looked at a year ago and said, if the cuts run as deep, frankly, as were recommended by the administration a year ago, we were looking at not doing some things that, quite frankly, I think are our job to do. But we had to prioritize and look at that. Through your help, through your work, the cuts didn't run quite as deep, and we're running, but we're on fumes right now. And my concern is that additional cuts are going to mean that the courts are going to have to implement those very changes that you helped us avoid a year ago. I I've got all kinds of more detail I was going to talk about, but I do want to be respectful of the time that you've got. I'm happy to answer any questions that you would have, and it is an honor to be back in front of you.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, Judge. And Mr. Saul, is Tim Osby here? Did he?
Mr. Chair, he is, but should we perhaps go to Teresa Kingsley and Becky Brandt, who are coming in from Olmsted County? These are court employees.
Yes, I think that would be better. And then on Tuesday, we'll have you back because I think we rushed your presentation in too much, and I think it's too critical that we need to really understand what these reductions are going to mean. We'll have Judge Toussaint back and give you ample time to discuss the cuts to the Court of Appeals. We'll have the tax court and try to finish up any other judicial matters on Tuesday. So with that, is it Becky Brandt? Teresa Kingsley, is that it? And you're both senior county clerks in the 3rd District, right? Okay, very good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Becky Brandt, and I've been an employee in the court system for 13 years. And I'm an officer with a member of the Greater Minnesota AFSCME Council 65. AFSCME Council 5 and 65 have a joint contract with the judicial branch, representing the public servants in the court administration in the seven of the 10 judicial districts. Excuse me. I am concerned with the impact of the inadequate funding of the judicial branch. Since the 3rd Judicial District went from county-based judicial service to state-based judicial service, it was apparent that the courts could no longer ensure that all Minnesotans could be assisted with the constitutional right of justice. This past year, the Judicial Council adopted the funding formula to be used statewide based on the staffing of large counties like Hennepin and Ramsey, where staff are specialized to do the large number of case filings. Large volumes and specialization allows for staffing efficiencies. Staff in smaller counties are expected to know everything and are frequently interrupted by the demands at the counter, over the phone, by the computer, and in the courtroom. But these interruptions are not really interruptions, but is an important part of serving the public. Due to the poor economy, we have an increase in unlawful detainer eviction actions filings. The hearing sessions are jam-packed, which is another hit to the courts. Mothers and fathers who are seeking justice and requesting evidentiary hearings are being told, I'm sorry, but the next available court trial date is 5 to 6 months out. Right now, when the judge requests that I schedule a felony jury trial, I am scheduling into March of 2011. And that calendar will end up having 15 or more felony jury trials and several gross misdemeanor and misdemeanors. Some of those jury trials will have to be continued due to the lack of calendar time. Just alone in Olmsted County right now, we have over 20 serious felony cases pending. Rape, murder, attempted murder, assault, and kidnapping. Because we are scheduling to the next year, the defendants are demanding speedy trials. We do not have enough staff, judges, or calendar time to meet the speedy demands. Calendar clerks are constantly bombarded with rescheduling trials that did not get heard and scheduling speedy trial demands. I work every day in the courtroom with judges in Olmsted County whose calendars are overbooked. On most days during the in-custody arraignment, the judges will have an average of 3 minutes to size up the defendant and make important decisions on public safety. Most days I go without any break. I eat my lunch while I work at my desk, preparing for the afternoon, the next day, are dealing with all the emails from public defenders, county attorneys, probation officers, jail staff, and information requested by court staff. I have to deal with the judge's mail and work coming out of the chambers. The cities and counties can hire all the deputies or officers they would like to satisfy the public safety demand, but eventually you will need court staff to process the complaint, schedule hearings, and process the judge's orders. The judicial branch cannot afford to take another hit by laying off more frontline workers. Fellow co-workers who have been laid off after years of loyal service to the state of Minnesota and who are now collecting unemployment and looking for jobs, struggling to make mortgage payments. Now co-workers are being asked to volunteer to be permanently reassigned to other counties. If they do not volunteer, they are laid off and lose their jobs. Yes, they are grateful to have a job, but the impact on families is immense. Not being able to see your children in the morning or being able to pick them up from daycare because you must drive, for some, 60 to 80 miles each way to keep their job. They take another hit with the cost of fuel. Some of us, like myself, have spouses who struggle to find work due to the poor economy. Now many more at risk of layoff. Tim Osby gave testimony last week before the Senator Foley's committee. Mr. Osby is the district court administrator for both the 7th and 8th judicial districts. While Mr. Osby has been faced with more and more cuts, he had the vision and courage to leave as many frontline staff unharmed while merging administrative duties between counties and districts. The vision of doing the least harm to the frontline and judge unit is what gives me hope that the mission of the branch and the clear rights outlined in the Constitution will be guiding force if further reductions are imminent. I love my job. I am proud and honored to serve the public and assist judges in their important role of administrating justice. Minnesota cannot afford to cut justice. And thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you. We have a question for you. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, not a question necessarily, just a comment. First of all, thank you for your testimony and your service. And I just want, I'm glad Ms. DeSalle is still here. I think we absolutely need to find efficiencies wherever we can. But I think your comment about making sure that as the state court administrator's office looks for those efficiencies, they remember that not every place in the state is like Hennepin and Ramsey counties. There are significant differences between Olmsted or Carver County or Scott County and Hennepin and Ramsey. And I think there's a lot that each of the judicial districts can learn from each other. There's things that the third can learn from the fourth and the second, and there's things that the fourth and the second can learn from the third or the first. So I want to acknowledge that and say that I agree with you there. I want the court administrator's office to find efficiencies, but just because it's done in Hennepin and Ramsey County one way doesn't mean that's the right thing for the entire state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Kingsley?
Aye. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Teresa Kingsley, and I work in Olmsted County as a senior court clerk, and I am a member of Greater Minnesota Ask Me Council 65. I have been an employee in the court system for 4.5 years and work primarily with civil, family, and commitments. Thank you for the opportunity to explain the impact of the inadequate funding of the judicial branch. I was happy to see the development of the Access and Service Delivery Committees formed recently to look at short-term and long-term solutions. I was able to join and sit on the Access and Service Delivery 2 Committee for the second half and on behalf of Ask Me Council 65. One of the measures taken to soften the blow from budget cuts last year was the increase in filing fees. With the increased filing fees, more people are applying in form of papyrus, so it appears we may be losing money. People who may have been able to afford the lower fees are now paying no fee at all. Who can afford a $100 motion fee when they can't pay their child support? Or what about the parent who can't meet their child's basic needs because the absent parent is not paying their child support? On a daily basis, I am the human factor to the public. Technological changes cannot answer the questions the public has that impact the lives of themselves, family, and friends. It is hard to explain to someone filing an order for protection and afraid for their safety that we hope to be able to contact them in the next 24 to 48 hours and whether that order has been granted or denied. Or explain to a parent who has been denied access to their child that they cannot get a motion date on the court calendar for another 2 months. With the shape of the economy, it is even harder to tell someone they can have a motion to modify their child support for 2.5 months. This creates an additional burden on the state when parents are forced to seek public assistance for the basic needs which would have been covered by child support. In Olmsted County, we currently send child support orders and default judgments to be processed in Houston County, conciliation court claims to be opened in Fillmore County, and until recently, citations were sent to Dodge County. I can't imagine the backlog we would have without the assistance of these counties. At the same time, the new funding formula you've heard of, referred to as the lowest norm, they are at continued risk of staff reductions. I am proud to serve the public. The judicial branch is not a program. It is a branch of government specifically tasked with ensuring all of our constitutional rights to justice and should be a top priority. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Leibler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome today. Thank you for coming up. And, you know, certainly I have heard a lot about stories coming from our court in Olmsted County. And one of the forces at play, I think, that hasn't been mentioned, and I wonder if you could just comment on it, is sort of the the special difficulty in Olmsted County with, well, of course, now with the difficulty with employment, perhaps it's not the same dynamic, but the difficulty in keeping people in the courts when there's competition from other, kind of the wage differential problem. You don't look like you know what I'm talking about. The problem of people getting taken away from the court jobs into, say, Mayo Clinic or someplace else where so that it becomes that much more difficult in Olmsted County. Do you know what I'm talking about? Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Brandt.
Representative Legley, I kind of do know what you're talking about because when we first faced the layoffs, we had 6 employees quit and go to Mayo Clinic. And that left us even shorter staffed. And now we're being staffed a little more by the permanent reassignments. We just got 2 employees, and we have 2 more coming. No, we have 1 more coming, and 1's going to be laid off probably next week because she will not drive 88 miles to Rochester. But the Mayo Clinic doesn't pay you that much money. I actually applied for a job there, and it was $10 less than what I'm making right now to start there with less benefits.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I think part of the issue was that when there's a hiring freeze, of course, as people leave, you can't replace them. And then if there's in different judicial districts, if people leave at different rates, there's, I think, an exacerbated shortage. So it sounds like maybe that isn't the case so much now, but maybe it was in the last few years.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative.
Ms. Brandt.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Is there any final questions? Representative Coles, and then I think we should probably wrap up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, a comment for you, I guess. I have here the Senate's proposed, obviously the Senate, Senator Pogemiller and his leadership have come up with targets, and Senator Higgins and Senator Foley have come forward with their recommendations. At least I have a spreadsheet here showing those. I'm wondering where Speaker Kelleher and Chairman Solberg and Chairman Carlson and yourself are at with regard to targets. I'd sure like to, you know, get to work trying to figure this out as quickly as possible. And obviously the Senate's moving forward. I hope we are, too.
We are moving forward, and we will have our targets soon, and we'll get to work expeditiously, Representative Coles. I promise you that.
I, Mr. Chair, I think on both ends that we have a bit of a broken record in this committee. I hope soon is very soon.
Thank you. For those who did not get to testify today, I apologize, and we'll see you all on Tuesday. Thank you, members. This meeting's adjourned.